Welcome to Perspectives, brought to you by Physicians Practice. I'm Drew Boxler, editor of Physicians Practice. Every 2 weeks, we explore key areas of a successful, thriving, independent practice. We'll hear from experts in the industry regarding best practices for billing and collections, answer your top coding questions, analyze current legal trends, malpractice landmines to avoid, and look at the hottest tech innovations to increase productivity and enhance the patient experience. Let's get started. In today's episode, you will hear a discussion between Ike Debji, an asset protection attorney and regular contributor to Physicians Practice, and Anthony Williams, an investment advisor representative and the founder and president of Mosaic Financial Associates. The two discuss how COVID-19 has affected asset protection and wealth building and preservation, impending tax changes, common asset protection and wealth preservation mistakes high earners make, and more.
Good morning, Anthony. How are you today?
Doing great, Ike. Thanks for having me. Looking forward to the conversation.
Me too. Thank you. For those of you who are joining us this morning and who may not be familiar with me, my name is Ike Debji. I'm an asset protection attorney and have been a contributing author to Physicians Practice for over 10 years, where I have a good backlog of a couple of hundred articles on asset protection, wealth preservation, risk management, and business law issues for physicians. I'm having a conversation about asset protection and wealth preservation this morning with an expert from the other side of the fence, if you will. And my guest is financial advisor Anthony Williams, who has over 25 years of experience as a financial advisor to specialty physicians, and who is the president of Mosaic Wealth Management, which operates out of Phoenix, Arizona. And Anthony and I are going to have a conversation this morning about some of the things that we encounter in serving physicians and some of our concerns for physicians. Of course, please do remember that anything presented in this context is meant to be as general and wide in scope as possible. And it should never be construed to be specific legal or financial advice that is specific to your facts and situation. So, Anthony, lots of things we can talk about. We could probably spend hours doing this, but we want to keep this brief and listenable and watchable for those folks who are spending some time joining us. So I'm going to get right into some questions, if that's okay.
Let's roll.
There's a lot of turmoil right now, right, with the markets, with the economy, with COVID, and the last 2 years have shown us the value of savings and the need to have an emergency fund, right? That's a big deal. And many people had to use those funds and those savings in ways they may not have expected over the last couple of years as we've gone through this crisis. What's a good rule of thumb to determine how much that liquidity should be? You know, everybody's supposed to have this emergency fund, but how do we figure out how much we should have? And what's the advice you're sharing with your clients on that?
Yeah, I like how you prefaced that question with COVID, because frankly, our general rule of thumb has changed to a degree, in many cases, depending on practice modality. But historically speaking, we've done a 3 to 6 months fixed expenses, not 3 to 6 months of all expenses. Our feeling is, you know, the travel, the hobbies, and the fun stuff, if we're in an emergent situation, we're probably not having to budget for during that time frame. We used to say 3 to 6 months, and I can tell you that once elective procedures for a lot of my clients were given the kibosh, there was just like even people making $500,000, $750,000 a year, whatever it was, they're like, do I have enough in liquid cash to nobody knew, right, how long this thing was going to go on and how long electives were going to no longer be operable for all intents and purposes. And so we've now extended that to a degree, and it's going to be client specific, as you kind of gave in your disclaimer. None of this is specific to everybody, but we have a lot of clients now that we're saying 6 to 12 months of fixed expenses parked away. Some people take a middle of the road approach and say, how about 6 to 9? However, I think one of the key things there, Ike, that we're doing too, is we're saying, hey, have about 3 to 4 months of expenses just at the bank, right? Checking, savings, something along those lines. But then beyond that, let's look at some type of like a tax managed investment, tax managed defensive, by example, where we're looking at money market, short-term yielding, maybe a small allocation, 3 to 8% of very small, stable stocks, something in that range. Just so if that way we're able to cover the cost of inflation on a bunch of money that's just sitting, for all intents and purposes, not being used, right? And so in this case, we can say, hey, let's have 3 to 5 months at the bank, maybe another 3 to 6 to 7 months in this more tax efficient environment, getting a higher yield.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. And I think a lot of people were surprised by how much of their liquidity they had to put into fixed expenses. And that's a great, thank you for the beautiful segue into my next question, which is, we've got some people who had some money put aside and were able to use that. We have some people who found that they didn't have enough. And that's why you and others have changed your recommended reserve amount. And then we've got some folks who are going way over to the other extreme, right? Where they're erring on the side of caution because they're afraid of both the securities market, they're afraid of the real estate market, right? We saw what happened, in fact, with many of my own physician clients who were heavily invested in income producing rental real estate, and then had a year or a year and a half where they couldn't evict anybody who couldn't pay. And they are carrying that out of pocket, the carrying costs, which in many cases are financed by the rent, right? So we've got a bunch of folks who are afraid of both dirt and securities right now. And they're all in cash, or they have too much of their allocation in cash because they're afraid of that volatility. What are some of the safe alternatives that you like that can hedge against downside risk? So I know, for instance, after the 2008 recession, people suddenly realized the value of senior secured debt or bonds or other things that before maybe weren't as sexy and didn't make as much sense. What are some of the safer alternatives to being all in cash and earning close to nothing on that cash?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. And certainly our clients have asked for the same solutions. So it's something that we're very attuned to. You know, you did mention bonds. So I think that merits mentioning. One of the approaches we've taken is that we're really utilizing short-term plays in that space, largely being interest rates are so low. So the last thing we want to do is have somebody own this super long-term bond and then just not have the ability to get out of it. Interest rates start to go up and so forth. So we're very, I guess the word I'd use is fungible in that space. So certainly that's a spot for it. But the reality is equities are a driver. I mean, everybody hears the expression that the only real, the only fire retardant to inflation is equities. But like you said, people are super anxious about that. And so we've utilized, without getting into a lot of the details of it, and I'll use a real life illustration to help people understand it, because it gets into the weeds a bit. But there are hedge strategies and then buffered ETFs that we've been utilizing in our portfolios for clients. And the best way that I can describe that is, and I don't know the last time you went bowling. I know it's been a while for me. I have a good friend of mine. He and his family go bowling quite often. And I said, do they have guardrails? Because that's what these strategies are effectively designed to do, right? Where we're still able to participate within the scope of equities, but we have some guardrails. So we have some downside protection, we have some hedges and so forth. So those are some of the things that we're doing as an additional diversify for our clients, looking for that added, you know, kind of risk reduction, but still wanting to have those opportunities.
And the liquidity is still there, it sounds like.
Still there.
Those.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
Excellent. Well, good. I'm glad you've got some strategies, and some alternatives to just being in cash. Another issue that's on everybody's mind is taxes, right? And we keep hearing lots of scary stories about what the president and this administration will do or not do. Obviously, on my side of the fence, on the legal side of the fence, we are encouraging people who are high net worth to make significant changes to their estate planning to be more tax sensitive and be more tactical in how they're approaching the estate tax changes. But on your end, I know a lot more of what you talk to clients about is probably more on the income tax side, right? So what are some things that doctors can do maybe before even the end of this year to hedge against this variable and some of the changes that may be coming, and whether those are changes on capital gains or income tax rates or all of the above, what are some of the things that you're talking about and doing?
Yeah, I mean, look, if I had hair to pull out, like, this would be one of those subjects that would necessitate, you know, maybe some more propitia or something, because it's just like, when is it going to happen? When are we going to have clarity? You know, I'm sure you've had the same conversations with your collaborative CPAs. Like, we just need to know. And so my first part of the answer to that question is just making sure that we're having proper engagement with our clients so they know, hey, once we know what's going to happen, here's the direction that we may go. Now, to be fair, our perception is taxes are going to go up, both income taxes as well as capital gains. Will it be as much as we've seen? Who knows? None of us know that. But if we go under the presumption that things will go up and it will go up at some point, the idea would be is if we have gains in our portfolios, non-retirement part of our portfolio, if we have those gains, we would be well-suited to have everything lined up so we can capture those gains, reset the basis, you know, and so forth. And so if we're at, look at what, capital gains at 20% versus 40%, that's a meaningful drain on wealth, which I know you and I are both focused on, asset protection and wealth preservation. Regardless of legal or financial, those are the things that we want to talk about. And so I think, you know, I like to use this expression all the time, PPPPPPP, the seven Ps, right? Prior proper planning prevents pathetic poor performance. Mark and I, just yesterday, my business partner had a conversation about if this does come through this year in calendar year 21, 422, that effectively our December, which tends to slow a bit, is not going to be very slow because of the logistics involved with all of the changes that would come down the pike with respect to those changes. So we have the tax analysis all already drawn up, ready to go with the various institutions where we have money held to say, where can we carve this out? It's just a function of when do we get to push the button and go? And none of us know that quite yet.
That makes sense. I mean, we're all planning for a best guess scenario, and that includes estate planners, right? Right now, we have this massive estate tax exemption where a married couple can pass close to $24 million worth of wealth to anyone they want with zero estate tax. Or if we're trying to scare people, we use the death tax. Yeah. And you use the scare quotes on that. But, we don't know if that is going to be reduced to 3.5 million per person or 7 million per couple or as low as 1 million per person and 2 million per couple. But we are suggesting that folks who are fortunate enough to have that problem do something about it now. And in fact, we're seeing folks finally taking that very seriously because of that potential exposure. So going back to what you just said, do you have when you talk to clients, is there a specific allocation to investments that are tax advantaged themselves internally? I know there's some things that we can invest in that are treated differently for tax purposes. And are your clients asking you about that? Has the demand grown where people are saying, what can you put me in that has the least tax load?
Yeah, so I think there are two questions in there. And the first part of that would be, do we have a specific allocation? In an ideal world, 100% of our clients' asset would be in tax-deferred vehicles, right? Or tax-advantaged vehicles. I mean, that would be fabulous. But without getting into too much of the detail, we know that you either have, you know, after tax and tax free with tax deferral in the middle, or you have pre-tax, tax deferral, and you pay tax on the back end. But the challenge with a lot of tax advantage investments are liquidity, right? And so if we have somebody that's getting started earlier, so I know that I'm guessing that the audience for this is a pretty broad mix of folks that are maybe even still in training or just completing training to folks that are in retirement in the medical space. And so initially, maybe it's, hey, I need to build liquidity. And then maybe I need to build some money into our education funds for our kids, or maybe I want to have an opportunity fund for if various real estate opportunities present themselves. But the reality is, after we check some of those basic boxes, you know, the opening question was, we have our emergency reserve of 6 to 12 months. We have a brokerage account somewhere in the neighborhood of, I don't know, depending on the client, maybe $250,000, $2 million. The reality is, once we've checked those boxes, like, I would like to see almost 100% of people's allocations going into these tax advantage strategies. It's just a function of timing. When do they get there? I think a lot of times what we're having to do to the second part of your question, which is absolutely, our clients are asking us all the time, what more can be done? And so there's certainly that urgency that exists currently that maybe hasn't existed previously. And so the conversations we're having are very much in alignment with, all right, you've checked these boxes, let's do these things now, or you still have a little bit to do here, a little bit of work to do here. I would suggest to you that a lot of our clients have said, I almost want to forego some of the messaging that we're providing with respect to liquidity and having a short-term and a medium-term bucket and saying, I'm more concerned with this, which of course that goes to clients prioritizing and triaging their respective goals and really their fears, because that's what we're talking about. I see many of these questions are driven by fear, which I'm not saying in a pejorative way, but that's, people are afraid of these things. And so we need to make sure to have solutions to help them out.
Well, that's good. That's good. I'm glad you're having those conversations. So I had some related questions, but I've asked you a couple of different things about our clients doing this or clients doing that or clients asking about this. Has this crisis of the last couple of years combined with just things like the FIRE movement in general, and for those who are unfamiliar with that acronym, it's financial independence and retiring early. Has this increased overall the level of financial literacy in the physicians that you're dealing with? Are they becoming more informed about these details where they used to maybe just allocate it to somebody like you, to handle for them? Obviously, and we all rely on advisors and professionals to do things that we don't do. But are your clients, is their level of self-education changing or increasing?
Short answer is absolutely, it's improving. And I think that there's two reasons for that. One, there's just more information available, right? And we can access anything at any given time in ad nauseum, frankly. But then secondly, one of the byproducts of COVID and people not being in the hospitals and not being in the ORs is they just simply had more time for the first time in their lives to actually look into this stuff. And I mean, thankfully, most of our clients, the lion's share of our clients, Ike, one of their big frustrations when they're doing what they do is when people come in and they've got their Google MD ready to rock and roll. And I'm sure you have the lawyer MD or the lawyer, same thing with Google. We get that, right? And right. I think, look, there's a lot of good foundational information that's available out there. But, as they say, information is just information. It's how do we craft all of that? And so certainly the conversations we're having with our clients are more intelligent conversations. And that's, again, I'm not speaking deprecatorily of our client base, but it's because they've been so busy and so immersed in their professional and personal lives. Well, now all of a sudden they've had time to look into these things. And so we're actually having, I like to call them more productive conversations, frankly.
Well, good. So let's go back to the FIRE for a moment, since that is such a big thing and there's so many physicians in it. In fact, I follow several of the leading physician FIRE authorities on social media. I'm part of a couple of their discussion groups in different places, and people are asking really detailed and precise questions. I mean, questions that are way over my head in terms of the technicality of some of the tax questions and things that they're asking. Are you seeing people saving more and sacrificing current lifestyle for early retirement? Is it changing behavior among those? Are some of your clients getting, for instance, less conspicuously consumptive and putting more money into their investment account than into their driveway? What's in their driveway, for instance? Are you seeing a sort of a paradigm shift in that? And has the, whether they're calling it that or not, have you seen the effects of this with the people you deal with?
So to a degree, I'm going to go to your paradigm shift because I like that phrasing. There has absolutely been a paradigm shift where a lot of our clients who have been buried in their careers and with their career probably in some cases more than their actual personal life, which is just the necessity of the career. I think the time of working from home or not being able to go to the hospital again, I think there has been a huge paradigm shift, Ike, where people are like, I like hanging out with my family. I don't want to miss these opportunities and these memories and these experiences. Now, the other part of, so yes, there has been a paradigm shift. I don't know that my clients have necessarily called it the FIRE movement. I think they're probably adhering to certain principles or underlying themes of the FIRE movement. But as you know, physicians are getting such a late start to begin with in terms of, their undergrad buddies who wrapped up college at 21 or 22 have at least 4 years of med school on them. And then you add in another 3 to 7 year fellowship, 3 years of residency or 7 years of training, potentially, depending on the nature of the specialty. they're starting out fairly delayed in life, right? And then
not to mention the 300 grand or more in debt.
Yeah, I was going to say, on top of that, they've got 300 plus in debt. And so what we've actually seen is a combined paradigm of I really want to spend more time creating memories and moments with my family and my friends, my loved ones. But I also just, I want to knock out my school loan as quickly as humanly possible. And then focus on more of the, now that doesn't mean they're doing that exclusively. They're still funding their employer-sponsored retirement accounts. They're still funding their IRAs and utilizing the backdoor Roth strategy where applicable. They're still putting money towards education funding. But I don't know that I see the standard of living, like what I like to call shiny object syndrome. I don't know that I see a withdrawal from that necessarily as much as, because it's kind of a replacement, right? All right, maybe we're not spending as much time at the country club or at, you know, various expensive things that we like to do, but we are spending more time with our family traveling and doing different things. And so I think it's kind of a, the lifestyle is more to have a lifestyle of balance. But as a result, I don't think our clients expect taking that kind of work-life balance approach that they're going to be retiring at 52 or 57, you know, but if they have a more moderate lifestyle, more moderate work-life balance, maybe they can extend that a bit longer while still adhering to many of the themes of the FIRE movement.
That makes sense. That makes sense. So not necessarily, it's not necessarily that you get to stop working earlier than the, you know, what we're all programmed to do, right? To age 65, you work as hard as you can for as long as you can. And obviously you and I both understand, and you especially, that that working as hard as you can is for as long as you can is not a good business model. And it's certainly not conducive to lifestyle and family and all the other things that you mentioned that people have reprioritized now that they've gotten a taste of it, you know, and been pulled out of that, off that hamster wheel, at least temporarily. So that, right, that makes a lot of sense. You know, my clients, my partners and I protect a couple thousand doctors across the country as part of a much larger client base that has a bunch of entrepreneurs and other successful people in it. And what I've seen over the last 10 years or so is that people are getting richer younger. It used to be that a lot of the people who used to come see me had gray hair before they felt they had enough money to spend some time and some money to protect it or to worry about it. And now I'm seeing people get smarter younger, and I'm seeing people earn more money younger. And whether that is maybe younger physicians that are, as you said, paying down debt, and immediately, as soon as they have some cash flow, they start investing in things that produce passive income, right? They start investing in real estate. They invest in an ASC with their buddies. They buy a share in a lab or an imaging center, right? Or they buy a rental home, or their spouse starts a franchise business. So we're seeing lots of people become more entrepreneurial, at least in my book. Are you seeing the same thing?
Oh, absolutely. Entrepreneurial. And the thing that I would add to that probably is, because of the availability of information and some of the time that people had, I find that folks that are coming right out of training or even while still in training have simply taken more interest and realize that I need to be disciplined in my approach to accumulating and protecting wealth because I am starting so far behind. Whereas I think before the mentality may have been, well, I'm going to make all this money, I can play catch up. And I don't see that anymore. I see a degree of urgency amongst all specialties where people are saying, look, I have money. I want to have a lifestyle, but I also want to be responsible with it. And the sooner I can do that, the better off I'll be in the future.
Makes sense. Makes sense. And now on a final note, I know the updated second edition of your book on wealth preservation for physicians will be out soon. And in full disclosure, I'm a contributing author. And very happily so. What are some of the key issues you felt that you needed to cover in the new book? And you know, what prompted you to put the second edition out now? You know, what are some of the changes, and what are some of the things that we can expect to see in that book? I know one of the things that you were focused on was providing a series of really actionable steps. What are some of the details on that?
Yeah, so I was really happy about this. And frankly, I'll pat you on the back here, Ike. You were in large part a reason that I wanted to write this book, because in our conversations through the years, it was, we focused on the legal side of it, the asset protection legal planning that, that you do so well. But the reality is, if you take the words, just the words as they are, asset protection, wealth preservation, it certainly encompasses a whole lot of other things. And when I look at my practice, and we take a very holistic approach to wealth management, everybody has investments and everybody has ETFs and everybody has tax advantage investments and all these types of things. And we're all kind of, I think, wired to grow our wealth and talk about the growth of our wealth. But what happens when certain things occur that could result in a wealth loss? And so that was really the gist of this, you know, the kind of the overall gestalt of writing this book and say, you know, taxes we've talked about, so I don't need to get into that. Legal, we've talked about that. And if you don't mind, I'll have some questions for you if we have time about how to flip the script here, so to speak. But what would happen if somebody has a long-term care consideration? And how much of a wealth drain would that be on somebody's portfolio and on somebody's life and on their lifestyle and on their family, right? And there are just a number of other things, you know. I just did this this talk for the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons in San Diego last week. And probably my favorite slide of my PowerPoint is a bunch of images from the Game of Thrones. And it says, what can we learn from the Game of Thrones? And my whole discussion of that slide is making sure that we have barriers, that we have barriers upon barriers, and we have different sort ways to restrict people or things or entities from gathering our wealth, whether that's the IRS, whether that's creditors, whether that's healthcare costs, all of these things fit into that. And so that was really the idea of the actionable items. And my hope is, because each chapter is broken down with an expert, we actually have about a page or so, page or two to support that. But then I actually have the interview embedded with those respective experts in that space. So people can say, boy, this is something that I have not addressed. This is something that I need to make sure to check the box on as we move forward.
Well, I like that approach. And I like the fact that you drew on the expertise of a bunch of people with different viewpoints. I know that you have a number of contributing authors who are all experts in different areas of law or finance or taxes, or, you know, they have slightly different viewpoints on tackling some similar problems. So thank you. And thank you for sharing that detail with us. So you had mentioned that you had some questions for me, and I'm happy to answer those. And so maybe this is kind of getting into part two of our discussion. And for those of you who, depending on where you're jumping in here with us, I'm Ike Devji. I'm an asset protection attorney. I've been practicing in this area for 18 years exclusively. It's the sole focus of my practice, is all I do. And I'm having a conversation with Anthony Williams, who is the president of Mosaic Financial Advisory Services. And Anthony has over 25 years of experience working with specialty physicians and addressing their asset protection, their wealth preservation needs, their wealth management needs. So Anthony, what are some of the things that are on your mind, or that are on your clients' minds about asset protection? What are some of the things that I can perhaps help answer?
Okay, great. So I think that we'll start broadly and we'll maybe kind of dive into some more specifics of this. So the super generic, this is when we write our articles and we want to have X number of bullet points for SEO, right? So this is one of those where we just say, you know, what are some of the mistakes that people make with respect to asset protection? I would hate to limit you to three or five or one to three, but what are some of the most common? And then what are some of the most costly of those mistakes that you've experienced in your 18 plus years of asset protection planning?
Oh, well, those are good questions. And actually, I think we even have an article that I've written for Physicians Practice where this discussion is going to be specifically titled Fatal Flaws of Physician Asset Protection Planning or something similar. And we may even link that to this video. But, the number one mistake that I see has been consistent since the first day I started practicing in this area, which is doing nothing. Right. And unfortunately, I get calls several times a week from people who I have to turn away. Because asset protection planning is legal when implemented under blue skies against the whole world and can be illegal, ineffective, or even considered fraud if you do it after something bad happens against one specific person. And no, that doesn't mean just because you haven't been sued yet, you can still act, right? So you know that if you have an adverse outcome with a patient and it results in an injury or fatality, that you have a liability. You know that if you or your spouse runs somebody over with your car, that you probably have a liability. So to try and go on a fire drill after that happens is unpredictable, it's expensive, and it's almost always ineffective. In fact, I have another article that, not to sound like a broken record, that did appear in Physicians Practice on exactly this issue, called A Real Life Story for Doctors to Analyze. And somebody who acted late went on a fire drill, set things up, transferred property, set up an LLC, stuffed a building into it. And everything they did was fraudulent, and they ended up losing over $500,000 of their retirement savings to settle out the case. It was a personal injury case related to an accident. So again, the number one mistake is still doing nothing. And we'll limit it to three, since you gave me that 1 to 3, that's a good place to start. The second most common mistake, I think, is relying on your trust, right? And when people say, I'm not worried about this, I quote unquote have a trust. And when I say, are you referring to your revocable living trust? They nod very proudly and affirmatively and confirm that. And I am, in many cases, the first person to explicitly inform a physician or someone else that the revocable living trust or family trust you have in place is a great estate planning tool. If you didn't have it, I'd want you to get it, but it offers zero protection against your creditors during your life. So that's the second most common mistake, is simply relying on a tool to do a job it wasn't designed to do. It is not a criticism of estate planning. It is not a criticism of revocable trust. But a saw is not a hammer, and it's just that simple. The third most common mistake, probably failing to adequately insure. A lot of the people who call me in a panic after something bad has happened, call me because they've been informed that they either are not covered at all for what happened, or that the amount of insurance they have in place is insufficient to actually cover the liability. The most common example of that is auto accident coverage. And I tell every single person I talk to that if you don't have a $2 million umbrella on your home and your automobiles, especially if you have kids in the house, you are nuts. I mean, it is dollar for dollar the most predictable, effective, and cost-effective asset protection you can put in place. And I routinely, almost on a weekly basis, turn away people who call me after a very significant car accident, including physicians with seven-figure and higher net worths who for some reason have $250,000 or $500,000 in insurance. Now, I don't want to get stuck on auto insurance, but since this is my number three point, failing to adequately insure can also mean not having the right kinds of insurance, right? So most physicians, let's say if we're talking to practice owners, they have medical malpractice insurance in place for an issue with a client. They have general liability insurance in case you or I go to their office and trip and fall down and get hurt. And in between those two policies is a universe of risk, right? There is employment law risk that has to be specifically insured. The average sexual harassment verdict in this country is currently $500,000, as one example. There is data breach and cyber liability risk is at an all-time high, right? There is RAC audit risk, right? For those who use Medicare and Medicaid as payment sources and for reimbursement. So these things need to be specifically insured for the right amount. And another common mistake related to inadequate insurance is many times I talk to docs about these specific areas of coverage, and they say, yes, we have data, we have cyber, we have employment law insurance, et cetera. And what we find is rather than having full policies at the right amounts, what they actually have in place is low limit riders on their medical malpractice policy of somewhere between $10,000 and $50,000 on each of the issues I just mentioned. And in some cases, those share the limits of the Med-Mal policy itself. So those things should be separately insured or insured to high limits. And in my case, I tell most people, small practice owners, that's $1 million per issue, right? So if we spent a couple $1,000s on EPLI insurance, which is that employment practices liability insurance, that would cover potentially not only a judgment or the actual liability, but what could also be hundreds of thousands of dollars in legal defense costs, right? I don't want my clients paying the damn lawyers out of pocket. I want them insured for that. Does that make sense?
No, absolutely. But I did have one follow-up comment on point number two. But I've had plenty of clients who've been at various sessions and presentations and industry conferences that were told, if you just put it into this trust, everything will be perfectly fine. So I feel like maybe there's some conflict there.
Yeah, there sure is. And, you know, unfortunately, a lot of the folks who show up at medical conferences are pay to play, right? They have paid or sponsored an event and they have not been well vetted in terms of their qualifications beyond being able to pay for the space as a vendor, right? So we often run into physicians who have gone to an event and whether they purchase something from an attorney or in many cases, a non-attorney promoter of legal services, somebody selling trust packages, trust kits, LLC kits are very commonly marketed to doctors, and it works because doctors are often cost sensitive. Right. So it is a much more attractive story for somebody to tell you that, hey, we're going to charge you a couple $1,000s and we're going to give you this LLC kit and this neat book and DVD and everything that you will ever run into or own will be protected by this, by you. And the nice thing is they don't have any liability for doing that, right or wrong, or the advice they provide, unlike you and I. Right? We are licensed professionals and we have professional standards and we have liability for what we do. So there is a disconnect there. I don't know how else to put it, except if it sounds too good to be true, it probably is.
Well, old wisdom carries through, right? So speaking of tools, I guess my next question then would be, those are the mistakes. What are some of the most common, or I don't know that I would call them the top asset protection or wealth preservation tools from your perspective that really, and again, doesn't apply to everybody, but in a general rule of thumb, what would be the top few things that, you know, you need to have this, and this in your situation?
Well, the things that are most universally applicable in keeping anybody safe, whether I'm talking to a physician or a real estate developer, or a client that owns a dozen franchise units, who's building a fabulous life and income stream for their family. It kind of all comes down to some basics. And I guess that's what you're asking. Number one is always compliance, right? What I call clean living. Let's not do things that get us sued. Let's follow the rules. Let's be ethical in our behavior. Let's be legally compliant in our behavior, both from a general legal perspective and then compliance in terms for physicians with standards of care and industry standards and other things that are profession specific. But I guess the big catch-all word for that is compliance, right? Let's not do things that get us sued, and let's not allow those for whom we bear liability, friends, family members, children, spouses, employees, business partners, all of those people fall under this umbrella. Let's not let those people do things that put us in harm's way either. So that is the first asset protection tool, is avoid the fight, right? The second most important asset protection tool, again, I don't sell insurance. I don't have a dog in this fight, so to speak, but I sure make people buy it. And is the second most important tool is insurance, all of the right kinds of insurance to the right amount. And I will say this again and again, dollar for dollar, it is the most predictable, effective, and cost-effective means of asset protection. And, that means we're covered for both the legal expenses on a controversy, which are easily hundreds of thousands of dollars, and the actual liability. And then the third tool, you know, the third most important tool is the legal tools, right? If our compliance fails, if our insurance fails, then let's have legal tools in place that made our personal assets legally distinct from our personal and professional liabilities, right? So if we own an apartment building or a rental home and we are a physician, let's make sure that rental home is not subject to our professional liability, right? So the third, you know, so we talked about first is compliance, second is insurance. The third defensive strategy must have is legal tools. And so which legal tools we want to use? The best answer is it depends. It depends on the facts of the person we're talking to. Do they have assets that should be protected, like their primary and secondary residences? Many of the people that I work with have very significant amounts of home equity above what their state's homestead law protects, right? For instance, where we are, you know, in Phoenix and Scottsdale, the homestead here has been 150, but there are entire neighborhoods, entire zip codes where every home is over $1 million, right? So those people have a very significant amount of equity exposed. Do they need their home equity protected? Do they have liquid investments with someone like you that should be in a wrapper in their taxable accounts? Do they have investment real estate that they shouldn't have in their own name, so that they are protected from the internal liability of owning real estate, and so that the real estate is protected from the external liability of being owned by a doctor who might get sued, right? So we factor all of those things in. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no. I mean, look, the thing that I hear you saying is it's a very specific process that is going to be driven by the client's circumstance, by their goals and objectives, and you know, what they have going on. And that actually is a great place to pivot into my next question for you, which is, you kind of started off by saying not having a plan or doing it, trying to do the plan too late. When is a good time? When should people be considering comprehensive asset protection planning? And what does that journey look like for somebody?
Well, you know, we have a lot of folks come to me when they have already accumulated a very significant amount of wealth. And the way I look at those people is that they're fortunate to have made it that far. And in many cases, those people have had significant setbacks along the way. I mean, you and I both know that some of the most successful and famous people in the country have been, for instance, bankrupt more than once, right? And yeah, it's great if you're able to recover from that and come out on top and have a great success story. But it's even better if we can avoid having to do that. So your question is a common one I get, which is kind of another version of your question is, how much money do I need to have to worry about asset protection? That's sort of the blunt question I get. And what I say is, when you have something to lose, and when you have something, an amount, an asset, a dollar amount in the bank, or whether your financial advisor, or an amount of equity in a property you've invested in, when you have something that you have worked hard for and don't want to have to duplicate that work to replace, then it's time to start. And there's something for everybody. Obviously, somebody of, you know, a 55-year-old ortho surgeon with a $5 million net worth is going to need a plan that is much more sophisticated, has more layers, and costs a lot more than maybe, you know, a younger physician who's got their first $100,000 in savings. And we should put some kind of little wrapper around that to make sure that that piggy bank that they've built is protected. We should make sure that they've got some basic estate planning. We should make sure, for instance, that they've got that $2 million umbrella policy on their cars. We should make sure that their disability insurance is at the right level, so that they don't have to spend that first $100,000 in savings when they fall off that mountain bike and break a shoulder, for instance, right? Something that happened to one of my young clients. And that's an interesting thing, because a lot of younger clients look at some of these risk management things as older people's problems, right? I'm young, I'm healthy, I'm strong, I'm a triathlete. And I say, yeah, you're jumping out of planes and, you know, bungee boarding and extreme mountain biking and doing all this neat stuff. And sometimes people get hurt doing those things, right? So it is a combination of risk management and what is right for you wherever you are. There is something that everyone should do that might not necessarily involve paying a lawyer, right? There are people who consult with me where I say, hey, get an estate plan, go spend money on disability insurance, go spend money on car insurance. When you have $50,000, $100,000, whatever that number is to you, come back and we'll start there and we'll securitize that and we'll add pieces to that as you mature and as your wealth grows.
Yeah, no, I mean, that makes sense. I'm glad you brought up the disability insurance because one of the chapters in the upcoming Asset Protection Wealth Preservation Manual is what worse way to erode wealth than to be disabled and not have disability insurance. And so I'm glad that you brought that up. You also brought up estate planning. And so there is something that I've noticed through the years, and it's, I wouldn't call it pervasive, but I would call it more common than it used to be, which is I have great relationships with estate planning attorneys. I have great relationships with CPAs. I have great relationships with, well, you're the only asset protection attorney I work with because I feel like I don't need to have another one. But the point is, I do run into scenarios from time to time where clients who've already have an established relationship with an estate planning attorney, and I introduce, hey, maybe it's time for, like you were just saying, that next level of asset and wealth preservation protection planning. And oftentimes the response received is, my estate planning attorney is handling that. Or my estate planning attorney says he or she does asset protection planning. So I see this kind of, and maybe they do, right? I'm not in a position to vet every single one of my clients' estate planning attorneys necessarily, but there does seem to be kind of that crossover into what I'll call your world or your lane. There are clear differences that you and I know, but would you speak on just kind of, we have this. Yes, they work together. They work in concert with one another, but could you just speak to that point a little?
Sure. And that's actually a great question. And it absolutely goes back to the misuse of the revocable trust, right? As a garbage can, as a catch-all, right? I've got a trust and my home is in that trust and my investment account is in that trust and my rental property is in that trust. So yeah, look, I think that the easiest way to make the distinction between estate planning and asset protection planning is the difference between death planning, which is estate planning. Who gets my stuff when I'm dead? What kind of estate tax exposure did we have? Who's in charge of it? When do they get it? Is it protected for them? So on and so forth. The corollary to that, which, as you said, these need to work together, is asset protection planning, which I really consider life planning, right? How do we predictably make money, keep money, and then pass that money on? How do we enjoy that money during our life? How do we have access and control over it for investment and entrepreneurial purposes? So many conventional old-timey estate planning strategies involve transferring wealth away from yourself to others in a way that restricts your use and control to a degree that it can affect your income, cash flow, and lifestyle. And look, this is again a very relative question. If I'm dealing with somebody who's worth tens of millions of dollars, which we often do, those folks can afford to carve out a very large chunk of that, put it in an irrevocable trust for the benefit of their children, and walk away from it, right? Knowing that it will never be subject to their own creditors, it will not be subject to their future estate tax exposure, and it will even be protected for the people to whom they left it, right? And then there's everybody else, right? Then there are what I call the working rich or the working wealthy, which comprises many of the physicians that we both deal with, right? People who, just like you and me, get up every day, go to work, have to take the kids to soccer practice, have to stop on the way home to buy dog food, right? These people don't feel rich, even though they may be in the top 5% or 1% even of income and net worth in the country. And so for those folks, having the ability to control where their money is, to change that allocation from real estate to securities to cash, to be able to collateralize some of their assets and savings, including their investment portfolios, to obtain credit, to be an investor in that surgical center, or to buy that first fourplex, right, that a young couple may be investing in as part of their income producing real estate portfolio. And these are all, you know, pretty common things that doctors do. I'm sure you see them all the time as well. We want to make sure that the tools they're using for those, number one, are going to allow that, and number two, are going to predictably hold up against any third party access or creditor claims, right? And they have a legal right to do that. And a lot of estate planning tools do things, you know, for instance, like put assets in the name of your spouse. Well, that's great. But once that's been done in a formal way through the use of a tool like a SLAT, that's his or her money, right? That is really no longer your money. So what happens in a divorce, right? So there are lots of high points and low points to these things that people don't understand or that aren't adequately explained. And I think it's important to use the right tool for the right job. And in many cases, traditional estate planning tools are not the right tools to own, control, use, and enjoy business assets, right? So we use personal tools for personal assets. We use business tools for business assets. And in many cases, those are intertwined. So we might use a limited partnership for both estate planning and investment management purposes. And, you know, again, we're combining that use there as one specific example. Does that make sense the way I'm saying?
No, look, I think the distinction is great. And hopefully people will really consider that answer, because I think that is a super important one. And now I'm going to give you a bit of a softball. This is an opportunity for you, because I already know the answer to this question, but I'm thinking for the viewers that are watching this interview today, they might be saying, man, I have a financial advisor and I've really never given much thought to asset protection planning before. What is, or how would a client go about engaging that process to collaborate, you know, you and their financial advisor together to be able to know what questions to ask? I mean, I've been fortunate to have your tutelage. I have a list. It's probably in one of your many articles of, well, do you have this? And so on and so forth. But other people may not have that resource. So for those of you that are listening here, that are watching, Ike's an expert in this space. You might have other advisors in your world. Here's that opportunity to say, how do you engage that process if you're feeling this is something of worth?
Well, you've got a few different questions wrapped up there. And yes, so let's go back to something you said, which is the list, right? When I talk to a client, I identify and ask questions about a lot of things that have nothing to do with legal planning that I'm responsible for, right? So I ask a lot of questions about risk management, and those may include questions of like, do you have a financial advisor? Do you have a financial plan, right? I ask questions about how much life insurance a person has, and is that amount of life insurance adequate to cover the debt that they have disclosed to me and replace the income their family will lose, right? You have different formulas. For instance, as a financial advisor, you folks have formulas about a multiple of income or a multiple of net worth and so on and so forth. And what I say is, somebody who's on the, who gets a more basic and practical question, when a client asks me, hey Ike, how much life insurance should we have? I say, well, your financial advisor has their own formula, but here are a couple of basic things that I think about. Number one, have enough to pay off debt that you want paid off if you're no longer there, and have enough to generate income that will replace the income that you've lost, right? So, you know, as one specific example, now I don't sell life insurance, right? But what I can do, I don't sell disability insurance. But when I notice, for instance, that somebody is making $30,000 a month and they have $7,000 in disability insurance and a big mortgage, that makes me say to that person, I need you to consider what your fixed monthly overhead is and if this is adequate. And if it's not, I want you to talk to your financial advisor about this. I want you to talk to your financial advisor about the amount of life insurance you have in place. I'd like you to have the account that your financial advisor, the taxable accounts that your financial advisor is managing for you, transferred into this new legal structure that we put together for you. And here's what you need to do. Here's what you need to give them to allow them to do that, right? You're going to have to give them the legal documents. You're going to have to give them the tax ID number. Here they are electronically. Please forward these to your institution, right? So I think number one is give them a specific list of things to address with their advisor. Give them the action steps required when you see that they need to do those things. For instance, it's just not enough to say, make sure these things get into your partnership. Well, how do we do that, right? Well, here's what you need to do. Here's what you need to call them and say, here are the documents you need to do that. And I think that if we can be specific in that way and refer back to the other folks who have the expertise we don't when we've spotted something, that is one very effective way to do it. And, you know, you may say to a client, hey, you don't have an estate plan in place. You need to talk to Ike about that. You bought another rental property, but it's in your revocable living trust when it should be in an LLC, right? You may spot some of those things, or you may just say to them, you should talk to your legal counsel about how you're holding this asset if you don't want to get that specific. But I think I'm not qualified to give financial advice. You're not qualified to give legal advice. We are both cross-trained to a degree and have enough familiarity to maybe, if we're lucky, spot some glaring omissions that a client has in their own plans. And it's important that we explicitly inform the client about that when we see it and ask them to address it with their counsel. And if that sometimes gets lost in translation, then, you know, we need to be willing to pick up the phone or send an email to the person and explain, hey, Anthony, I was talking to your client, Dr. Shapiro, and Dr. Shapiro said X, Y, and Z. What can you explain what you meant or what your concern was? And I think that ability to retain a little bit of humility and ask questions of people who are experts in areas that you are not is very important. And the second, as I said, then the first thing is be specific and make sure that it gets followed up on. So we do reviews, for instance, with our clients where we can ask, hey, on our last time I asked you to increase your DI insurance or talk to your advisor about that, or I asked you to get EPLI insurance on your business in case there's an employee lawsuit, did that happen? Right. And there are many different kinds of advisors, right? There's you, there's me, there's the P&C, the property and casualty agent, we might use both of us as a resource. There's a CPA involved who maybe needs to look at something that a client's doing. So all of those folks, they don't need to be best friends, but they certainly need to be able to communicate and they need to be able to be specific in what they want clients to talk to other advisors about.
Yeah, I mean, look, I love that. And I love how you said we can cross train, right? As you know, I have this weekly series called Whiskey and Wealth Wednesday. And recently I've been doing a series about the 13 wealth management issues. And interestingly, one of the more recent episodes, I was talking about beneficiary entitling of documents and so on and so forth and how important that is. I had more people reach out to me as a result of that Whiskey and Wealth Wednesday saying, hey, can you help me with that? And I said, well, no, I'm just letting you know that those are the issues. I can help you identify an attorney that can help you to make sure that your incapacity planning, like your estate planning and your will and your trust, because that was all kind of fitting into this series that I've been doing. And it was just interesting to be able to say, hey, I'm not the attorney. I just happen to be speaking about things that, you know, kind of cross over into that world. Here are some of the gaps or some of the deficiencies that we've identified. Talk to these folks. And then most importantly, once we have a follow-up conversation, did you do it? Because inactivity, lack of action, whatever you want to call it, is We're all busy, right? It doesn't make its way to the top of the to-do list. So I appreciate, you know, your answers to those questions, because I think that especially for the folks that are listening, because it's for them, that they might now say, whoa, there are some things I need to start thinking about. And perhaps, you know, we talk about building the financial mastermind team, right? You and I've talked about this before, to make sure that we have advisors in these different lanes. And generally, I think physicians appreciate that, because if, you know, you were using the example, if I go out and I'm mountain biking and I break my shoulder, I'm not going to go see a cardiologist. I think physicians generally are in tune to that. So I thought that was a great answer. So I appreciate that, Ike.
Well, thank you. And thank you for spending some time and going over some of these issues today. I'm asset protection attorney Ike Devji. My guest is Anthony Williams, president of Mosaic Financial Associates. We appreciate you spending some time with us. We hope that this discussion about you between two professionals that serve the medical community has been helpful. And Anthony, hopefully, if you have some time in the future, I'm sure there are other things that we need to talk about. And I'd love to do this with you again sometime.
Always enjoy the time, Mike.
Thank you so much.
All right. Cheers.
Thank you for listening to Perspectives, brought to you by Physicians Practice. We hope you subscribe or listen to podcasts, rate us, and let us know what topics you would like to hear more about. For more practice management insights from the top experts in the field, be sure to visit us at physicianspractice.com and sign up for our newsletter.